Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Diana Opong, in for Libby Denkman. In 2020, amid racial justice protests, King County Executive Dow Constantine vowed to close the newly built youth detention facility in the next 5 years.
We will work toward entirely closing centralized youth detention at the Children and Families Justice Center by the end of 2025, as has been demanded by Black Lives Matter of Seattle and King County.
Earlier this year, that deadline was revised, and Constantine acknowledged that his original goal won't be accomplished until 2028 at the earliest. A new county audit of the facility, called the Judge Patricia H. Clark Children and Family Justice Center, points out the complications of actually accomplishing Constantine's goal. The number of youth held at the facility has gone down from 62 to a daily average of 49 youth from its peak in 2018. But King County's audit found that while fewer youth are in the detention center, many youth who are there are spending longer periods of time detained. The audit said that not charging low-level offenses has led to lower rates of detention, but that leaves youth with the most challenging and severe cases left in the facility, and those cases are difficult to clear. KUW's Ann Dornfeld is an investigative reporter here. She's been following this story. Thanks for coming back on Soundside.
Thank you for having me.
So the Judge Patricia H. Clark Children and Family Justice Center, the mouthful, is the only youth detention center facility here in King County. And I've been there before. I don't know if you ever have, Anne. Have you?
I've been in briefly, but not for the full tour.
Okay. So I actually worked on a project for KOW for about a week a few years ago. And people may be surprised kind of what it's like inside. Like, it's a beautiful facility. And the facility does more than just securely house youth. It has courtrooms. The youth that are detained there have school and a variety of related programs like yoga. The secure detention facility is located on a lower floor of the building. And it's not like what people may have seen in reality documentaries like Locked Up. It has murals and bright colors and a decent-sized library and a gymnasium. When I was there, the kids weren't walking around with shackles or handcuffs. And it's a place made for kids. One youth who was aging out and moving to the adult county jail described the facility as being like a daycare compared to what his time in adult jail would probably be like.
Not surprising.
But in general, the facility has been a topic of intense debate, right, in the county for years. Listeners may remember the no youth jail signs that appeared around the city a few years ago. Before we dive into the findings from the audit, for those who may not be familiar, Anne, what's the history here? Why has there been an issue with people wanting not to have a youth jail in our city?
Well, you know, the county's old juvenile detention facility was more what you'd think of by a youth jail. It was in bad shape and falling apart. So when they planned to replace it with this brand new $242 million facility, there was a lot of opposition to the plan. It had a lot of beds in it, and the argument was, oh, kind of like Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come, that the county builds a lot of space for young offenders that they will just go out and find kids to put in those beds. That hasn't panned out in reality, but part of the reason is a lot of different laws and policies have changed. So the occupancy is very, very low. But protesters actually have called for an end to juvenile incarceration altogether. They point to the disproportionate number of youth of color, especially Black young people in the criminal legal system. They say that it's traumatic for kids to be in detention and that it very often leads to struggles that follow them the rest of their lives, with increased risk of recidivism and potentially prison time as adults. Now, County Executive Dow Constantine, who had originally been a backer of this new facility, kind of pivoted and eventually pledged to end secure detention for youth in King County by 2025, calling it a system rooted in oppression. We should also distinguish that I did not know this before I started covering this issue more deeply, but the distinction with detention is it is before a case has been adjudicated, right, before it has been resolved. Earlier this year, though, the executive Constantine acknowledged that the timeline is not feasible and that 2028 is a more realistic goal for phasing out secure youth detention in the county, that it has a lot of moving pieces and it would be hard to accomplish before then.
Yeah. And let's dive into that sort of backtracking that Constantine had. Why was there this pivot that he was for it and then all of a sudden, no, we're going to try to close it? Do you know why that pivot occurred?
I mean, from what I hear from people who were there at the time, this was, you know, a very, very, very vocal group of people who were basically saying, you are criminalizing youth making mistakes. You are taking a racist approach to working with vulnerable young people. And especially at, you know, an inflection point in 2020, this was a move that the county could make and that the executive could make to shift direction. But of course, it's easier to, you know, make these promises and pledges than it is sometimes to actualize them. And that's what we're seeing today.
Yeah. And Dow Constantine has vowed to end youth detention. But what exactly does that mean? Where will youth that the courts have deemed need to be detained go?
Well, the county put together a committee to try to work out a plan for what that could look like. And the committee includes judges who work with young people, detention staff, some of those community advocates who were calling for an end to detention, public defenders, other community members, all coming together to kind of debate this. I understand from people in the committee that it was a messy process and kind of felt disjointed. But in the end, they came up with a plan that they all kind of agreed with, which was that there could be a centralized center for receiving young people who have been booked. Mm-hmm. They would stay there for only a few days maximum and either be released to their parents or they or families, or they would be detained longer. It would be in group homes, basically, that would mm-hmm. house 1, 5, 10 youth scattered throughout the county. Those would be in different neighborhoods, rural, suburban, urban. And that would be kind of their longer term pre-adjudication detention location. But a big point of contention was whether the group homes would be locked mm-hmm. and even whether the receiving center would be locked. So that was something that some folks like the detention staff and the judges were very, very firm about it being necessary. And others like the public defenders said, no, we want there not to be locked doors.
Right.
So they still have to kind of reach some agreement on that.
Yeah, that was actually going to be a question I asked you, Anne, because at the detention facility, it is locked. Like every single door you walk through has some type of lock. You have to use a separate key to go out as you go in. Like they are not messing around with making sure the kids are secured in whatever area they have been put in. Do you think the plans are feasible? And what sort of roadblocks might the county run into when it comes to closing this facility?
Well, you know, the first major roadblock is that there is a state law that requires that each county has secure youth detention. Secure obviously means locked. And that law would need to be changed, which is possible. There could be a workaround there, but it would need to be a change in state law. There's, of course, lots of other issues like what do you do with a juvenile who is accused of murder?
Yep.
It's kind of hard to imagine someone in, you know, any town in King County wanting that young person to be in an unlocked group home in their community. Mm-hmm. And then there are other issues like if it's not locked, then could it be something that someone, say, in a rival gang could enter the building and, you know, have a, you know, skirmish with an opponent. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there are lots of different kind of security elements there. And then also there's the aspect of would staff feel safe working mm-hmm. in a building where you had, you know, violent young people who have been charged with felony violent crime you know, roaming around, and you just have to try to negotiate them back into their rooms if, you know, things are getting a little wild. Right. So, I mean, a lot of it seems tricky to comprehend how that could work. Realistically, it probably on a good day would be fine, and on a bad day, maybe not so much.
Yeah, some more things to figure out. So let's get to the audit. This audit was released last week by King County. What was the purpose and what data was the county even looking at?
Well, the auditors were looking at how long young people are now spending in juvenile detention and how they are being served while they are in juvie. Okay. There have been a lot of policy changes and law changes in the past decade, and even just in the time that this audit looks at, that have really changed who ends up in detention and how long they stay there. So the audit was examining that and recommending some changes that might make life better for the young people who find themselves there.
Yeah. And one of the main takeaways from the audit was that average length of stay for youth in secure detention. Looks like it tripled between 2017 and mid-2023. How long are kids ideally supposed to stay at this detention facility?
Well, it's interesting because the detention facility was built with the idea that young people would only be there for 30 days or less. However, in 2017, the county started housing youth charged as adults in juvenile detention rather than at the adult jail where they used to be housed.
Got it.
And with those more serious and complicated cases, young people often stay much longer. So if the goal is to have kids at juvie for a month or less, even in all of 2023, the average length of stay was only 22 days for young people who are being charged as juveniles. If you're being charged as an adult, though, the average was 250 days. So that's like 8 months,
mm-hmm.
a long time. And some young people were in for longer than a year.
Right.
So we really have some, you know, some outliers. But those outliers, you know, do constitute about, you know, one third of the young people who are in juvenile detention. They're being charged as adults. Another thing that's changed is that since 2017, there's been a lot of change in who is booked into detention versus who is, you know, booked and released. It's primarily only more serious felonies mm-hmm. these days. It's, you know, things like first degree assault or second degree assault or, you know, armed robbery. It's not shoplifting or drug offenses, things like that. So that has changed a lot. And those young people were going to be spending much less time in juvie. Even today, the audit found that most young people are spending a week or less. But there are some who are spending a very long time there. And it was not meant, the services there are not meant to serve young people for that long.
For long term. Is the change in where we're housing youth and the types of crimes that are being committed, have they escalated to be more serious over the years?
Well, that's also happened.
Okay.
You know, we had a very large juvenile crime spike in King County last year alone. It was about 61% more bookings than the previous year. And this is at a time when they aren't even, you know, booking everyone. So that says a lot. And also a considerable, although not as high, increase in juvenile violent crimes. But there are a lot more juvenile violent crimes that they're seeing these days. There's some different factors that play into that, I'm sure, and people have their arguments. But yes, there has been an increase in the number of young people who are committing more serious crimes and committing them at younger ages.
So the audit noted that the average number of young people at the center has decreased over the last 5 years, though that number has been rising in the past 2 years. I'm a little confused about that. And what contributed to that recent
sure.
rise?
Okay, so the number went down a few years ago when they stopped booking, you know, misdemeanors or lower level felonies. Those are often now put through diversion, either a court sponsored diversion, or they don't even get charged to begin with, and they go to this community based diversion that's called Restorative Community Pathways, which is a major county program. So a lot of these lower level felonies and misdemeanors aren't ending up in the youth jail to begin with. And that has changed over that period of time. So that decrease too is going in. Of course, COVID also decreased because they were trying to have very, you know, minimal number of young people in jail at that time. But then it's increased since COVID as, of course, you know, people have started behaving more as they did before COVID. And also that pressure of COVID has not been there. And the recent spike in juvenile crime, a lot of it actually has been the kind of Kia theft, the Kia cars, and Hyundai thefts. Mm-hmm. Those are considered, in many cases, more serious felonies and can often lead to other crimes. You know, we've heard of pot shop burglaries, kids ramming the, you know, stores with stolen cars, or carjacking people and, you know, running around town and hit and runs. So that can, those stolen cars can contribute to these secondary serious felonies that land young people in jail.
Okay. And the audit also pointed to ongoing staffing challenges at the facility. How many people are currently working at the center, and how many are supposed to be there?
Yeah, well, the most recent numbers that they looked at in the audit, they had 91 staff members, juvenile detention officers, who were supposed to be working there, but one third of those positions were unfilled.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And in speaking with juvenile detention officers, what they tell me is that with a lot of hiring incentives, financial incentives for new hires, they actually do hire a lot, but even more leave. The turnover is very high. The work is hard. There's often mandatory overtime that not everyone is down for. And then there's the kind of thing has been looming over their heads, recently alleviated a bit, that the building was going to close down and that this was, you know, all going to be done by 2025. So mm-hmm. it sounded like a temp job until recently. And it's not something that, you know, it's harder to get people to sign up for a temporary job, of course.
Got it. Because they know it's closing. So it's like, I don't have a guaranteed job.
Right. But then now, you know, it's going to be 2028 at the earliest, and it's questionable whether that will even happen. So that might, you know, encourage more hires. But it's still, you know, it can be a tough sell.
So they're having trouble recruiting staff. Is that also why they're having trouble retaining staff?
I think, you know, with the retention, what's interesting is that, you know, the low staffing can beget more low staffing, because okay. if you're understaffed, that's stressful for everyone who works there. And if they're understaffed, they're also more prone to riots, to, you know, young people having behavior issues. And if they're understaffed, not only do they feel less capable of handling that, but they can do fewer programs that kind of stave things like that off. So like you mentioned, the school that's offered in juvie, or the additional programs like yoga and other things that really kind of, you know, make kids' days and break up the monotony, those are often canceled when there's understaffing. So in order to have enough people on the floor at once, one of the things that they do, one of the strategies, is that the detention officers will take lunch together so that they can, you know, the rest of the time be fully staffed. But when they take lunch, then there's a lockdown. And what the audit found was that young people are spending about 2 additional hours locked up in their cells because of this understaffing every day. And the less programming, you know, kids can do, and the less, you know, freedom and flexibility and normalcy they can have, things get disgruntled, and, you know, you can face some mutinies. So, and just bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it all kind of feeds into itself. Mm-hmm. And the irony has been that in this effort to end youth detention, because it's harmful to youth, the county has kind of painted itself into this corner in some regards, where the staffing is not high enough to give young people what they need, or to plan for what all these young people who are facing adult charges are going to need when they're staying for, you know, months or a year.
Yeah, there's a transition sort of program to kind of get them, or at least process, from what I remember when I was there. And I saw the same thing you just mentioned, things being canceled because they didn't have enough security officers to just walk a particular group down, right? They need at least 2 officers, and then they're stuck in their rooms. And we're both moms. We know kids get stir crazy. They are still kids. Even though they might have done some violent things, they're still kids. Their brains are still developing, and they need to move, and they need to interact and socialize. But they are literally locked in a cell and can't really do that. So that is hard for anybody. And I know that's, I think, hard for the staff who know this is good for those kids, because they build relationships with them, and it makes it really tricky. You have spoken to judges, court workers, and staff about the county's goal to close the Judge Patricia H. Clark Children and Family Justice Center. What did they tell you about their plans to close this facility?
They said that they have a lot of concerns about how the plan as it stands right now could keep young people safe, could keep workers in these new facilities safe and could keep the public safe. They acknowledge that there's a lot that can be done to improve youth detention and the system at large, but that a plan that doesn't take into account all of the needs, say, you know, drug treatment or school, a lot easier to do if you have one facility and people can get it, you know, in larger numbers.
Versus piecemeal around the county.
Right, of course, right. And that they all have spoken very compassionately. It's been nice to hear about the young people who are involved, but that they all have some serious misgivings about what the plan that has been introduced, how feasible it would be, and whether it would be in the best interest of the young people who are supposed to be turning the corner and finding a new path in life.
What's King County's next step in its attempt to close the youth detention facility? What are they looking ahead to try to figure out?
Well, one of the things they need to figure out is how they could change the state law that requires youth detention, secure youth detention in each county. So that's a major one. But the committee that came together that I mentioned earlier to make the proposals for what a new system could look like, they went on hiatus after they made those recommendations in the winter and have come back together. They're going to be meeting next month is their next meeting, and trying to hammer out some of those finer points and answer some of the questions that were unanswered. For instance, would these facilities be locked?
Yeah. So, Anne, one of the things that you just mentioned that I'm thinking about, and I wonder if this has been talked about within the committee, is it possible to maybe consider, we don't close it because we need to have a facility. Let's say we can't change the law. We need a place to house these youth while they're finding a new path, getting the services that they need. Can we adapt what the facility is currently doing to meet those needs that it's not currently able to?
Yeah, and that was an argument that, as I recall, the representatives from the detention officers had. They said, you know, we have this $242 million building that is secure, that we know well. We've been working in it for 4 years now, and we know its ins and outs, and it was built to serve young people for a short term. So if our goal is to have a, you know, 3 day or less of, you know, receiving facility for young people who've been booked on crimes, this would be a marvelous place to do it and then release them to whatever the, you know, longer term care is, whether that's home or whether that's smaller group homes or another option.
Yeah, this is fascinating. And I feel like this story is so not just important for the public to think about, but parents. And I'm really fascinated by this whole thing and all the complexities that go into it, thinking about the kids and their safety, but then thinking about the public safety and the guard safety. There's just a lot. And then I come back to the fact that there's still just kids. Like, some of the kids I saw were like 12, 13, 14, like my mm-hmm. kid's age.
Yeah.
And it's devastating.
Mm-hmm.
They're not with their families. Yeah. They're not with their loved ones. Some of them have girlfriends. Like, I don't know. I remember what it was like to be a teen, and to be in that type of situation sounds awful.
Yeah.
Anne Dornfeld is an investigative reporter who covers government accountability at KOW. Thank you so much, Anne.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.